When Francis Fukuyama's first book appeared, unfriendly critics downgraded it, saying he was a mere State Department official. How could a bureaucrat have determined the end of history? I included him in the next to the last chapter of a book I did. Some of the earlier figures included Abraham Lincoln, Lyndon Johnson, and a number of presidents. I entitled my piece, History as Endpoint or New Beginning. And I guess what I was, I don't quite know what I was trying to say, but I guess what I was trying to say was that this boldness in moving into an area of fundamental importance foreshadowed what was likely to happen in the future in his career. Because right or wrong, satisfy or not satisfy, the students of Hegel and others, Gertrude Himmelfarb and various people, that book published in 1992 appeared in 24 foreign editions and was a bestseller in the United States, France, Japan, and Chile. His second book illustrated, I think, some of the same qualities. The book entitled Trust, The Social Virtues and the Creation of Prosperity, it anticipated many of the problems that we struggle with today. And his third book was The Great Disruption, Human Nature and the Reconstitution of the Social Order. And his most recent book is entitled Our Post-Human Future, Consequences of the Biotechnology Revolution. Brought him new responsibilities. He became a member of the President's Council on Bioethics. So his work has challenged us all. It's forced us to think hard, as he thought hard, in 1981 and 82 in the policy planning staff, where in that stint of service, he actually had responsibilities in the Middle East for Middle East policies, and especially Egyptian-Israeli talks on Palestinian autonomy, where he was a member of the U.S. delegation to those negotiations. But then in 89, when he came back, he dealt more with European-American affairs and military and strategic. And so it seems to me that it's not out of order that he be discussing with us the world crisis and saying some things that perhaps have not been said in previous discussions in this book. Because what we need as we think through our way in this very treacherous and difficult aspect of our relations with the rest of the world is clarity. And his clarity comes from just having come back from 3 weeks in Europe. And there may be a little different emphasis than if he had not made his European trip. But it's a great pleasure, Frank, to welcome you, and we look forward to the presentation.
Well, Ken, thanks very much. That was a very generous introduction, and I'm really delighted to be back at the Miller Center. I'm also happy to have a chance to talk about something other than biotechnology. I can get back to international relations, which was really where I started my academic studies. Like a lot of other Americans, ever since September 11th, it's been very hard to think about anything other than those events and what their implications were for world politics. And of course, in my case, since I'd written a book entitled The End of History, I was immediately phoned by a number of journalists wanting to know, well, what had happened to history. And over the months, you know, in thinking through this seriously, I had developed a kind of standard response to that. In many ways, Samuel Huntington and I had polar opposite views of the post-Cold War world. He had argued that there would continue to be conflict based on cultural difference, and I had argued that, in fact, there was this process called modernization that was a global process that would gradually envelop larger and larger parts of the world and would produce relatively similar institutions, would lead to liberal democracy and to free market capitalism as really the only serious alternatives for modern societies. And of course, with September 11th, you had Mohammed Atta that lived in the United States that was not seduced by its consumerism or other, you know, democratic freedoms, representing a larger movement of Islamic radicals that clearly didn't buy, you know, the most basic tenets of either westernization or modernization. And so it was a serious challenge. Now, that talk I can summarize in about two sentences. I still believe that, in fact, modernization and the, you know, the international dimension of which is globalization will remain the major structuring principles of world politics. And I think that the challenge posed by Islamic radicalism, although very real in the short run, is not a viable alternative, or not nearly as viable, for example, as socialism, which was really the last alternative that we had to contend with. It has no appeal for people that are not culturally Muslim to begin with, and even within the Muslim world, I think the appeal of actually living in a Muslim theocracy is very limited, and we actually have, you know, now empirical evidence from Iran and from Afghanistan, where people having to endure that kind of religiously based dictatorship, you know, end up not liking it and in fact wanting to join the modern world. And I would expect that that is the line of development over the long run that is going to be inevitable for Islamic societies. However, as Ken mentioned, the world has moved on and there are a lot of other issues that have cropped up. And one clear issue that really emerges now, especially since the end of the Afghan phase of the war on terrorism, is really the question of the United States in the world, and whether the issue in world politics is really not going to be the West versus the rest as the major fault line, but rather the United States versus the West, in which even countries of the North Atlantic Alliance that were American allies throughout much of the Cold War distanced themselves from the U.S. as a result of American unilateralism, the great disparity in power between the United States and virtually everyone else in the world. And it's that question that I want to take up. I think it doesn't really, in a way, affect this larger answer about the end of history, but it certainly is an extremely important issue for world politics, and as we'll see, involves some very basic questions of democratic theory and what we mean by democracy at this juncture in world politics. Now, let me begin this topic, and it's going to focus a great deal on the United States and Europe, by a quotation from an article that appeared in the French newspaper Le Monde shortly after September 11th by Jean Baudrillard, who is a major French intellectual sociologist, has a very venerated place in the intellectual pantheon in contemporary France. He wrote an article basically in which he said that the World Trade Center tower is self-destructed in a certain sense. He said, ultimately, it is they, i.e. the terrorists, who've done the deed, but it is we who have wanted it. Terrorism is immoral, and it responds to a globalization that is itself immoral. And I think the essence of this article was to say, to draw a kind of moral equivalence between the United States on the one hand and Osama bin Laden and the terrorists on the other. And in some sense, what he represented, you know, his France or Europe was a kind of civilized pond protected space between these two contending fundamentalisms. On the one hand, the fundamentalism of Osama and the Taliban, and on the other hand, the fundamentalism of George W. Bush. Now, of course, Baudrillard does not speak for all Frenchmen, and in fact, he was criticized in Le Monde in a very penetrating article shortly thereafter by Alain Minc. But this is not an uncommon opinion in Europe, and I think Americans, in some sense, are a little bit sheltered from the kinds of attitudes that you see very commonly expressed in Europe, that essentially the United States deserved what it got on September 11th, that as a result of its foreign policy and its power and role in the world, that it had this coming sooner or later, and that this was the only viable expression of resistance to that American power. I mean, even people like Will Hutton, who is a Laborite journalist who's just written this, you know, prolonged diatribe against American foreign policy, wrote earlier this spring, "This is not the same good America that reconstructed Europe and led to an international liberal economic and social order after World War II. This has somehow become an America hijacked by a bunch of social conservatives or religious fanatics that are dragging the world into a new form of conflict." Now, I think that in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, there was, of course, a big upwelling of spontaneous sympathy for the United States all across Europe. After the State of the Union address and the Axis of Evil speech, I think a lot of that, or virtually all of that, dissipated. And so, although European governments have been officially quite supportive of the war on terrorism, particularly after the Axis of Evil, you got the German foreign minister, Joschka Fischer, and the Hubert Wedlin, I mean, various European officials quite openly criticizing American foreign policy. And you get the return of a lot of complaints, European complaints, about our attitude towards global warming, towards the death penalty, and so on and so forth. There's one poll, in fact, just two anecdotes. I mean, there's one poll that showed that 30% of Frenchmen think that the United States is actually France's most important enemy in the world. When I was in Europe, in the UK, promoting my book on biotechnology, I was interviewed by an environmental activist who said that she was so angered by the Americans forcing her to eat genetically modified foods that she was tempted at times to want to plant a bomb under the U.S. Embassy in London. But of course, she wouldn't do this because she was a pacifist. So. Now, the question, I think the larger question this raises for us is, you know, we, during the Cold War, we had this concept called the West, that we were defending against communist expansionism, that it was a realm of shared values and institutions that was bound by very deep, not only historical, but also, I think, normative kinds of ties. And if, in fact, there is a deeper split between U.S. and Europe that's revealed by these kinds of comments, I think that is in itself an important issue. And I think the answer is, unfortunately, my bottom line is going to be a little bit yes and a little bit no. I do think that there is, in fact, a fairly deep and important difference in the way that Europeans and Americans look at issues like democratic legitimacy. But let me go on to explain. The nature of the explicit European criticisms of the U.S. really all center on the role of international law, international organizations, and international norms. And I think anyone that's followed foreign affairs in the last 6 months is perfectly aware of the kinds of problems that have arisen. The Europeans disliked intensely the Bush administration's withdrawal from the Kyoto Protocol. Prior to that, the United States had refused to sign the Rio Pact, the withdrawal from the ABM Treaty, our unhappiness with the landmine convention, the treatment of the Al-Qaeda prisoners held in Guantanamo Bay, our refusal to join the International Criminal Court, our reservations about the revisions to the Biological Warfare Convention, et cetera, et cetera. The announced plans of the Bush administration to seek regime change in Iraq to get rid of Saddam Hussein is regarded by Europeans as a further example of this kind of unilateralism. They do not support it, and our announced intention to go ahead even without that support to them opens up the possibility of virtually unlimited American use of power outside the bounds of any, you know, set of legal norms or rules. And in fact, I think the United States did, with the Axis of Evil speech and then with President Bush's West Point speech in June, announce a fairly important shift in foreign policy, What President Bush said is that given the possibility of terrorists armed with weapons of mass destruction, you could not guard against every container or individual immigrant coming across U.S. borders. There were times when the United States would have to act preemptively in order to meet that challenge. And I think in Europe, this was really met with a lot of horror, that they had been trying in Europe itself to develop a rule-based system of international norms, and the United States was basically saying that there were no norms that were going to constrain it in this prolonged war. Robert Kagan, in an article in this summer's issue of Policy Review, reviews, I think, quite brilliantly the whole European-American split, and he has this brilliant way of putting it. The Europeans, in his view, actually believe that they've reached the end of history, in my terms. That is to say, they've now reached a world order in which there's a great deal of consensus about democratic norms and values, in which the relationships between countries are not based on power politics, on the kind of realpolitik that Hans Morgenthau and Ken Thompson, defined in their classic book, but rather ones that are based on, some version of Wilsonianism, or before that, a kind of Kantian liberal internationalism. That is to say, that's the way that the Europeans view the world, and that therefore the old rules of power politics don't apply. In Kagan's view, that's right for Europe. That's the way that European states interact with each other. But the United States, in a certain sense, still believes that it is living in history because it has to deal with, among other things, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction. And his particular metaphor is that the United States has brought Europe to the gates of the promised land, and the Europeans can go through those gates, but the United States can't, by virtue of the fact that its military power really anchors that world and makes that end of history world in Europe possible. And so therefore, the Europeans are free to cavil at the American lack of rules and norms and so forth, but the reality of the world is that it's full of still very dangerous people for which military power is the only and necessary solution. Now, let me go over what's really involved here. One question has to do with whether this rift over unilateralism, supposed American unilateralism versus European respect for rules and international law is genuine. And I think that is actually open to question, that Wilsonianism and liberal internationalism, of course, are very deeply embedded in American foreign policy. The United States played a major role in establishing the League of Nations, even though we didn't ultimately join, in the United Nations after 1945, in the Bretton Woods institutions, in GATT, the World Trade Organization, a whole host of international, rule-based international organizations. I think that it is useful to distinguish between two forms of liberal internationalism, that having to do with economics and that having to do with politics and security. In the economic realm, the United States has, of course, been a leader in the creation of international norms. I think that that's not a surprise, since globalization, in a certain respect, bears a made in the United States label. American companies are all over the world. Without an international, liberal, international rule-based order, the United States could not profit from the global economy to nearly the extent that it does. And I think that in the last two or three decades in particular, the American focus in building international multilateral institutions has shifted away from the political ones really to the economic ones. And so therefore, I think without the U.S. Pushing at the WTO really never would have gotten a start. And I'd like to point out that well beyond the trade regime, there are a multitude of economic international regimes or governance institutions having to do with product standards, with safety, with airline, with bank settlements, even with things like how the internet is governed. And the United States is an absolutely full participant. And the European record on multilateralism in economic institutions in the last 10 or 15 years is not great. And I would say, it's a little bit hard to tally up these tit for tats, but I would say that actually the Europeans have probably behaved unilaterally more often than the United States. Now, this is a little bit hard to say after the steel and agriculture bills that just came out of the Bush administration. I actually regard that as a kind of normal hypocrisy that all major trading partners engage in. I mean, we were just the last, with an egregious offense in that realm, but the Europeans certainly protect their agriculture to a greater extent than we do. But the Europeans have also done a lot of things that are not particularly norm-based, and I think that is a part of the result of this European Union decision-making system, which is a system, it's an institution of Byzantine, unbelievable complexity in which Brussels is really not able to force national governments to enforce their own rules, and so you get this very complex interplay between, you know, Americans and a whole set of decision makers on the European side of the pond. And there are a lot of cases where the Europeans have actually unilaterally applied their rules to us. This is true in the case of genetically modified foods, where the European precautionary principle has been really enforced against U.S. farmers in the area of data privacy. In competition policy, it was a European regulator that prevented GE and Honeywell from merging, and so on down the line. The Europeans, you know, clearly had an international arbitration panel, you know, vote against them in the banana dispute, in the beef hormone dispute, and they violated, you know, they stood in violation of those clear decisions by international organizations. I mean, it took 9 years in the case of bananas. They still haven't complied with the beef hormone decision. So in the economic realm, I don't think that it's possible to even, you know, say that there's a difference between the United States and Europe with regard to unilateralism versus multilateralism. Virtually all of the major disputes in which unilateralism is an issue come in the realm of security. Of that list that I read you, two are related to environment, the Rio Treaty and the Kyoto Pact, which is a different. But the International Criminal Court, the ABM Treaty, the Guantanamo Bay Biological Warfare Convention, all of these really have to do with potential constraints that would be put on American freedom of action in the military sphere, including, and the International Criminal Court is opposed by this administration, I think with some, justice, because they are afraid that some European jurist is going to get into his head to try to indict an American, you know, serviceman in a peacekeeping mission, for creating collateral damage, you know, in carrying out something that by American law would be a perfectly legal military operation. So virtually all of these are security related. Now, I think that it is possible to overstate the extent of this conflict in the sense that the Bush administration, for all that it's got a lot of very experienced people in it, has been remarkably, in my view, ham-handed in dealing with allies and explaining the American position, and I think has brought on a lot of these charges, you know, unnecessarily. For example, you know, we didn't have to withdraw from the Kyoto Pact. I mean, Bush could have just done what Clinton did. Clinton signed that pact knowing that it would never get through the U.S. Senate, and in fact, you know, the Senate voted something like 99-1 against it in the Clinton administration, but he just let it languish before going to Congress. You know, Bush could have done the same thing, but instead he, you know, announced in principle that he wasn't going to abide by it. Europeans have a lot of stylistic problems with the United States. They didn't like the phrase the axis of evil because they have become among the most secular societies, you know, anywhere on the planet, and they simply do not like religious language or moralistic language. And Americans, you know, for various reasons, continue to be much more religious than Europeans, and that language appeals to American ears in a way that it doesn't to European ones. And in general, I think a lot of the, you know, the problems created by the axis of evil could have been mitigated by better consultation and explanation and sort of patient diplomacy of the sort that I think was quite routine in the days of the Cold War alliance. Furthermore, I think that Americans quite rightly have been accused of using strong-arm tactics to get their way in international negotiations and then walking away at the last minute. This has a long history in American foreign policy. Colonel House and Woodrow Wilson, you know, created the League of Nations, and then we decided we weren't going to have anything to do with it. We shaped the Rio Biodiversity Pact, the Kyoto Protocol, the International Criminal Court, and at the end of all of that strong-arming, we said, oh, and by the way, we're actually not going to participate. So I don't think you have to be a squishy European, you know, multilateralist to find this kind of behavior a little bit irritating if you are not an American. And again, this is all stuff I think that is fairly superficial and could be taken care of simply by, you know, a different way of talking and negotiating and the like. However, I do believe that there is a much deeper issue involved in the way that the Europeans versus Americans regard the source of international law and its legitimacy. And I believe that for the most part, these are going to be fairly broad generalizations that will, like many generalizations, oversimplify matters. By and large, Americans do not believe that there is any higher source of legitimacy other than duly constituted constitutional, you know, democratic bodies like the United States under its constitution that serves as a source of international legitimacy. So that, in other words, to the extent that any international institution has legitimacy, it is because that legitimacy starts with the people and their sovereign, you know, in their sovereignty, handed up through their representatives, through their government, that is then handed upwards to an international organization like the Criminal Court or the United Nations or the World Bank or whatever that institution may be. And all of those, you know, those organizations are only as good as the contractual agreements that created them. They do not have any autonomy and legitimacy in themselves. And I think that, you know, I know that on the left, for example, there are quite a number of people that would be quite happy to see American foreign policy constrained by, you know, the United Nations or by, you know, various kinds of international agreements. But again, that is only on the security side. If you put the shoe on the other foot and asked an anti-globalization activist, should the United States throw out its environmental protection laws because the World Trade Organization, you know, some arbitration panel said that they were a non-tariff barrier to trade, they would have exactly the same, you know, kind of Jesse Helms reaction to that. Who the hell is, you know, the WTO to tell us that they, that we cannot protect the environment and, you know, tuna fishing or you know, I guess dolphins and tuna caught in tuna nets and this sort of thing. So I think that this is something that actually transcends left and right in American politics. Now Europe, I think, is simply different. In general, more Europeans than Americans believe that there is something called the international community that is a more fundamental source of legitimacy than the legitimacy of any individual European nation state, even if those nation states are duly constituted democracies. That is to say, there are norms and rules that exist out there above the level of, you know, any sovereignty. That, in a sense, hands down legitimacy to those international organizations. And so you can regard all of these organizations, you know, beginning with the UN, but the Criminal Court and you know, Biological Warfare Convention, so forth, all of these, by this view, are imperfect realizations of the will of that larger democratic international community. And therefore, although you may have problems with the specific implementation, you know, in any one of these institutions, the fundamental source of legitimacy is really not in question and cannot be overridden, or, you know, normatively should not be overridden by the even the most democratic of, you know, sovereign nation states that make up that international community. Now, question is, who's right and who's wrong in this understanding of international law? In my view, I would have to say that the Europeans are theoretically right and practically wrong. How's that for splitting the splitting the difference? That is to say, I think that it is theoretically impossible to argue that simply because a duly constituted constitutional democracy decides to do something, that there is no higher principle by which one could say that that was, you know, something wrong to do. I mean, a case, came right out of our you know, national history and was fought out, you know, in battlefields not far from here, something like slavery. I mean, the issue really in the Lincoln-Douglas debates was that, you know, Douglas said, you know, procedurally, as long as the United States makes a decision that slavery is legal, there is, you know, no basis for criticizing that institution. And Lincoln really could not refer to anything in the Constitution to defeat that argument. He had to go to the Declaration of Independence and a higher principle that said that all men are created equal. And I think if you think about it, I mean, if, you know, the United States were to, you know, launch a, you know, truly aggressive war, you know, drop nuclear weapons on, you know, innocent people, you know, with no provocation, without any pretext for self-defense, even if that had been voted by, you know, solid majorities in both houses of Congress, I think, you know, virtually any American would say, well, of course there are higher rules that would say that that was something wrong and that, you know, just because it was done by a legitimate democracy is not a reason that you cannot criticize that. So I think in that sense, you know, the Europeans are quite right to say that there are norms that are higher than the positive law of any given country. The problem, I think, really entirely exists on a practical level, which is to say that any given interpretation, I mean, it, in a sense, it's very dangerous to say that there is this thing called the international community out there whose legitimacy is higher than any sovereign nation state, because who interprets the will of that international community? The reason that we have institutions and not just a kind of amorphous, you know, participatory democracy is that we have to have very specific procedural rules for gauging what the actual will of that community is. And I would say that here, you know, the problem really is a kind of twofold one, that any existing international institution is, you know, to the extent that it derives its legitimacy not as a contractual relationship from sovereign nation states, but somehow as a manifestation of a higher, you know, set of moral principles, is really subject to being hijacked by various kinds of elites in their interpretation of what that international will is. And I think the Europeans are actually quite guilty of this all the time. I mean, one interesting fact, although Europeans criticize Americans for the death penalty nonstop, it turns out that if you look at opinion polling in Europe, a majority of Europeans approve the death penalty and actually wish that their countries had it. But I think because of the nature of European, most European societies, they are in fact in certain ways less democratic, or elites are able to you know, to maneuver their political system such that they do not have to respond to, you know, the popular will in quite that fashion. And I think, you know, the United States is quite right to be worried about this idea that if legitimacy really comes from this willowy, you know, evanescent international community as interpreted by European jurists or by, you know, the staff of a particular international organization, that it will actually not reflect anything like the will of the international community. It'll simply reflect, you know, the particular people that are running those organizations. The second real problem with the European, the second practical problem with the European position has to do with enforcement. You know, the reason that sovereignty and the nation state will never go away in the foreseeable future is because the nation state is the only institution that is capable of enforcing rules. And enforcement means you can get guys with guns to walk up to somebody that's breaking the rule, hold the gun to their head and say, if you don't obey, you know, we're going to pull the trigger or take you to jail or whatever. It's the monopoly of force, the legitimate monopoly of force within a defined territorial area. That was Max Weber's definition of the nation state. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that there is no other source of enforcement other than nation states in the world today, and international norms and international institutions still rely on nation states for enforcement. Now, the Europeans have a different attitude towards law. They, you know, they pass human rights, you know, I mean, it's quite amusing, actually, if you want to look at the Spanish or the Portuguese, you know, list of basic, you know, rights in their basic law. I mean, so, you know, in the Portuguese case, it goes on for about 6 or 7 pages and includes, you know, right to health care benefits and, you know, a lot of other things that we would not regard as fundamental law in this country because they are not enforceable. And in fact, I think in the United States, we have, you know, very fundamental to our concept of a rule of law is that you don't make a rule unless you really expect that it can be enforced. And so to say that you've got this realm of norms and laws at an international level that really are not enforceable by anyone, but are simply expressions of, you know, of good intentions, I think for raise legitimate questions about whether that doesn't, you know, in some sense undermine the broader concept of a rule of law. So those are the, you know, I think that, you know, that's in a way where we stand, theoretically correct and practically extremely problematic. Now, why do these European-American differences exist? Bob Kagan, in the same article in Policy Review, says that it is the result, actually it's a confirmation of realist international theory. He says that it is the result of the disparity in power between the United States and everyone else in the world. And there's a certain obvious logic to this. You know, if you are a small, you know, you're Liechtenstein or Belgium or, you know, not to speak of a powerless third world country that is being acted on constantly by multinational corporations or intervening, you know, military forces or your neighbors or whatnot, of course you are going to prefer a world in which the large powers are constrained by rules. And naturally, if you are the United States, where you can pretty much do what you want and are acting on people much more than you're being acted, you know, against, then you're going to want everyone else constrained by rules, but you're not going to be very happy when those rules apply to you. And in a way, it's you know, just a question of the balance of power. If the European, if the shoe were on the other foot with Europe, you know, they would behave in the same way. And arguably, as I've said, in the economic sphere, they do act that way. I mean, the Europeans can enforce their rules on food safety on American farmers simply because they've got a large enough market that, you know, their threat to exclude American farmers is a pretty potent threat. And similarly, in the, you know, in the security sphere, you know, the disparity in power is really the greatest. And it stands to reason that everybody else that's not the United States, you know, should want a more norm and rule-based kind of international system. Now, I think that this is all fair enough, but it doesn't really go nearly far enough to explain what I think are some of the more abiding differences. And I will cite, you know, two other sources. The second, probably most important one, is the entire European experience of European integration, particularly since the signing of the Maastricht Treaty, the adoption of the euro, and the greater integration of European societies. Europeans have been, in a practical way, forced to give up sovereignty in very vivid ways. I mean, you know, what could be more vivid than turning in all of your, you know, your currency last January and getting, you know, completely new banknotes in response to them. And in fact, this is a continuing process where European sovereign decisions by European parliaments have been overturned by European institutions at a higher level. You know, the British, for example, had a gaze in the military rule, much like the United States, which was ruled invalid by a European court. And, you know, British just said, okay, fine. Can you imagine that ever happening in the United States if some international court said that our, you know, gaze in the military policy were, you know, were not, didn't live up to some, you know, international standard? And so, in a way, the Europeans have been, you know, their public opinion has been so bludgeoned by this constant, you know, retreat of sovereignty that it seems quite natural that everybody else should enjoy this kind of masochism as well. And when the United States doesn't and says, no, hell with you, you know, we're not going to listen to these rules, they say, well, what's wrong with you? You know, don't you know that everyone actually does this? Now, the third and last, I think, really important divide between Americans and Europeans is not a special characteristic of Europeans so much as a special characteristic of Americans, which has to do with American exceptionalism. When I was at George Mason University prior to coming to SAIS last year, I was a colleague of Seymour Martin Lipset, the great sociologist and political scientist, and we taught for many years a course on comparative politics. It was based around his book, American Exceptionalism, which I would strongly recommend to you if you haven't read it. But he really explains why the United States is an outlier among all developed countries, and that's true if you throw in, you know, Japan and some, you know, fast developers in East Asia, that the United States is really quite unique among developed democracies in quite a number of ways. And, you know, it has to do with the size of the welfare state, the anti-statism, you know, the dependence on laissez-faire solutions, you know, the deep and abiding commitment to free markets and the like. And I think a lot of this really has to do with the fact that American identity is, in a certain way, quite unique, certainly when compared to most European societies. That is to say, Americans do not have a kind of racial, religious, cultural, traditional sense of who they were prior to the actual founding of the United States of America. American citizenship is basically civic and it is political. It is not based on the ancient, you know, French people or Japanese people that have been here long before modern democracy ever arrived on the scene. It was really something that was created in 1776 and 1789, and since it is now by far the longest standing democracy in the world, it is now invested with a considerable amount of tradition and moral weight, which is what allows Americans to to think of their institutions as really quite not only exceptional, but exceptional in the sense that they represent universal values. If you if you take out a dollar bill and you look under the Great Seal, with the all-seeing eye and the pyramid, there is a Latin motto that says "Novus Ordo Seclorum." New order of the ages. So right from the beginning of the founding of the United States, there was a sense that this was not simply, you know, our government and our territory that was being established. This was a new order for the whole of mankind, and that our institutions, in a certain sense, were a certain model for the rest of the world to follow. And I think that Wilsonianism and a lot of American liberal internationalism in American foreign policy proceeds, precisely from that set of assumptions. Now, if you think about the typical European country, they come from a completely different place. If you are Germany, your democracy really only existed since 1949. You do not regard your institutions as unique or exceptional or a model for anybody. In fact, you regard your own institutions, including your democratic ones, with a certain amount of suspicion, because it was the bridled exercise of German sovereignty that got your country into a horrendous amount of trouble in 1939 that wrought untold damage on neighbors and the world order and so forth. And so all of these things that Americans are quite comfortable with, military power, patriotism, the use of force around the world, the idea that your institution should be a model for a lot of other people, simply do not apply to a country like Germany. Not to speak of smaller European countries like Belgium or Holland that could never ever kid themselves that their institutions would be a model for anybody. And in fact, they tend to think of their institutions at the lowest level of legitimacy and international organizations and institutions at the highest. All of these countries are ones that have had very troubled national histories where their institutions haven't performed so well and had to be replaced by other ones, whereas we have had a continuous political history since our founding. And so this is, I think, where things are left. I believe, actually, that because of these rather abiding differences, for all of the reasons that I've mentioned, that these issues having to do with international law are not going to go away. And in fact, I can only see them getting more neuralgic as the years pass. I don't know that this actually, is sufficient to revive history, but it certainly will make life interesting in the future, and I think it will tend to undermine that assumed community of interest that did exist previously in the West. Clearly, the big issue that stands before us is, if the Bush administration decides to take on Iraq. And here, I would simply put the issue, this is a question where I am actually quite uncertain as to my own opinions, and I think it all boils down to, you can put the issue in the following way about whether we are genuinely at the end of history or not. That is to say, if, like most Europeans, you believe that September 11th was a kind of one-off affair where Al-Qaeda just got lucky on this occasion and that in the future they're not going to be lucky, we've put up defenses and, we've done various sorts of things to, to prevent that from happening again. And in any event, the possibility of smuggling, terrorists smuggling a nuclear weapon into New York Harbor or something is fairly low. Then, of course, the risks, and I think there are undeniable risks in a American invasion of Iraq, are, not going to be worth the gains. You can simply wait till Saddam Hussein, dies of a heart attack or whatever, and whatever successor regime comes is almost got to be better than what we've got now. Or if you believe that the world is fundamentally changed and that, the real threat is, the possibility of non-state actors, getting weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein has got a very bad track record with this respect, and, the likelihood that if he gets this kind of weapon, he will actually use it, then I think, you know, quite legitimately, it's very hard to see why the United States ought to be constrained by these kinds of rules in protecting itself. I guess I tend to think of the threat more, I tend to think that we have been overplaying that threat. Although I have to always say to myself, you know, I and my family live in Washington, D.C., and if I'm wrong about this, you know, it is me and my family personally that are quite likely to suffer from it. But I think that, you know, in a sense, that, you know, is kind of at the core of the issues in world politics now, and I don't see any easy resolution of them, whether we do go into Iraq or whether we don't, because I think that this, I think rather, you know, important gap in perceptions of democratic legitimacy really is, you know, a characteristic of the world right now. So I'll stop talking. Thank you very much.
I have a note. Since we have almost a record crowd, there are people in the outer area, and would the questioners please use the microphone? So who would like to begin the discussion? Colonel?
Wait for the microphone, please.
What would you think if the United States and its allies were to put out a bill of indictment against Saddam Hussein for war crimes, terrorist activities? Certainly anybody who pays survivors of terrorists qualifies as a terrorist, and bring him before an international tribunal like The Hague or someplace and see if he can get an indictment against him.
Well, you know, I think in a way that demonstrates the weakness of all these international institutions. I mean, you in fact do now have this International Criminal Court where you could, you know, quite legitimately bring him, and certainly nobody would argue that he doesn't deserve to be tried by that kind of a tribunal. But, you know, the problem is with Slobodan Milosevic until he was turned out of office is how do you get him to The Hague? And I think that's where, you know, American power becomes paramount because he's, you know, he isn't leaving Baghdad, you know, until I suspect he's on his in his coffin. So, you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's fine in principle, but I don't think it would solve our security problem if, in fact, you know, he is on the verge of getting nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. I don't think that by itself will help us very much.
I think if I could take the measures we used against Milosevic and apply them to Saddam Hussein and force him into a position to comply.
Saddam Hussein, I think, is a much tougher character than Slobodan Milosevic. I mean, Milosevic, like a lot of other dictators, made this miscalculation that if he held an election, he would get reelected, and he wasn't. And then there was a mobilization, you know, as a result of the bombing in the Kosovo War that, you know, led to this uprising that led to his eventual fall from power. And I think none of those are going to exist in Iraq.
They're testing the fire alarm, but there is no fire. So, next question. Yes.
Could you tell us what to do about the American dilemma of trying to spread the virtues of democratic government around the world in face of the apparent fact that democratically constituted Islamic societies would be more hostile to us and our interest than their authoritarian regimes at present are?
Yeah, okay, so the question is whether we can help actually spread democracy in, you know, in Muslim countries. Well, I think, first of all, we have that responsibility. I mean, it's hard to imagine Afghanistan is ever going to be a democracy, but there, and certainly if we invade Iraq, we will actually basically have these two protectorates in which we are responsible, if not for democracy building, certainly for state building and for putting in some basic, you know, institutions. And there, I think it's a question of our just not getting tired of the burden of doing that. And in fact, that's one, you know, that's one real consideration about an invasion of Iraq. I suspect if we go into Iraq, we aren't going to get out of there for the next couple of generations, you know, because the task is going to be that hard. For the other parts of the Islamic world, it depends, I think, on a number of things. It depends on what examples of democratic governance, you know, emerge. I think that it is quite possible in the next generation that Iran will democratize and liberalize in I mean, it actually is a democracy. It's just not a liberal democracy, but it will liberalize in very, you know, astonishing ways that could set, you know, an important pattern for other parts of the Islamic world. But I think fundamentally this is a process that is not under our control, that what has to happen is a dialogue among Muslims themselves and a very clear-cut rejection of radical Islamism. And unfortunately, I actually, you know, don't think that we've seen nearly enough of that, or it's a combination of intimidation and confusion and, you know, kind of circling the wagons mentality that, you know, a lot of Muslims that, in fact, would like a more liberal version of Islam and would like, you know, to enjoy modernization and would like democracy, you know, have not been, I think, sufficiently, you know, strong in the defense of it. And so I think that's a long-term process that's, you know, I suspect is going to occur. It's going to be very painful and so forth. It's one that we can affect at the margins, you know, among other things. I think it was important to defeat the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan because, you know, in a sense, success breeds legitimacy, and by, you know, by showing that this is a dead end, you know, you reinforce the illegitimacy of that route. But it's, you know, I would imagine that that's a very long-term struggle ahead.
Question from the next room. Why isn't the European community more concerned about Iraq?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, they're closer to the Middle East, and in certain ways, Iraq could be a greater threat. I think it's probably a combination of factors. It's not in their interest to see Iraq as a, you know, major threat. They can't, even if it is, they can't do very much about it, and they've, I think, gotten used to dealing with threats that they couldn't, you know, do very much about over time. And I, you know, I do think that there is a legitimate threat assessment question that I, in my mind, has not been completely resolved. That is to say, you can say that Saddam Hussein is one of the worst butchers, you know, since Mao or Stalin or you know, Pol Pot, a very evil guy, very aggressive, no good intentions at all towards the United States, but he is still deterrable in terms of using, you know, using a weapon of mass destruction against the United States. I mean, I think, you know, the current scenario is that Saddam builds a, you know, a nuke and gives it to a terrorist organization who then, you know, becomes his delivery vehicle in the absence of ICBMs. But, you know, I think there's a question of really whether he would be willing to do this, and I think there's some evidence that would suggest that he is, in fact, deterrable. He had chemical weapons in the Gulf War, did not use them against American troops, and I think under the current atmosphere, you know, the likelihood that, you know, he could get away with, you know, this kind of covert, you know, gift of a nuclear weapon to a terrorist is fairly small. So if he is, in fact, deterrable, you know, the containment strategy, for all we know, might work. But, you know, as I said, if I'm wrong about it, you know, I and my family suffer personally from this. So, it, you know, I think it's a very difficult judgment to make. And, of course, the Europeans whose families don't have to worry about this, you know, can much more easily say, yes, that's, you know, the threat is really not, you know, not nearly so severe.
Next question, Robert Hola.
Two very quick questions. One, do you think that Europe will ever become or will ever act like a nation state in the sense that you use the word? And the second question is, well, let's get the first one first, if you could answer that one.
Well, I think that Europe already acts like a nation state in certain ways, and in, you know, that mostly have to do with economic policy. So that those instances of European unilateralism that I cited, you know, before actually are the sorts of things that nation states do all the time in kind of the global trade, you know, world. But, you know, the most central attribute of statehood is really military power. And there, I think that, you know, the likelihood that the Europe will act, you know, it'll field a European army, that it will use force in, you know, in a way that a typical nation state has, I just don't really see happening anytime in the near future. I see no interest. I mean, this is why, you know, Kagan argues that the basic problems are due to European weakness versus American strength. But that really begs the question of why the Europeans are so weak. I mean, there's nothing that constrains any European government from spending more money on defense. You know, the Bush increase in the defense budget that he announced last fall, $58 billion, is more than the largest entire European defense budget of any, you know, of America's European allies. And, you know, they could be spending the money. They're rich countries, but they just, you know, for various political reasons, don't want to. And then they've got these very severe collective action problems that prevent them, as in the Balkans, from actually using what military power they have in a particularly, you know, effective way. And I really don't see that changing very much in the coming years.
Innes Claude?
I wonder if the differences about international law, which we've emphasized, don't come in large part down to the point that the United States adheres to the traditional versions of international law, and the Europeans tend toward newer ones. For instance, the new International Criminal Court treaty is in violation of traditional international law in the sense that it purports to establish jurisdiction over the nationals of states that have not ratified the treaty. The United States says, if we don't ratify the treaty, our people are not involved. The new international law says everybody's involved, right, regardless of ratification. How would you react to that?
No, I think that's right, but I think that if you ask the question, well, where does this new international law come from, I really do think that it is ultimately rooted in what I was referring to about this very different European conception of the source of legitimacy, because, you know, if you just go through the thought process that led to the formation of the International Criminal Court, you have these people like, you know, like Milosevic or you know, genocide people in Rwanda or, you know, Saddam Hussein, who commit what everybody agrees are crimes against humanity. And you need some way of bringing them under, you know, the power of this international organization, which is why it has to apply to countries that haven't ratified the convention. And that's legitimate because you do believe that there are such a thing as human rights and universal principles, you know, these universal liberal principles of the way that regimes ought to treat their you know, citizens that are divorced from sovereignty. And so that leads then to, you know, this dilution of sovereignty in the European, you know, the European view. So, yeah, I mean, I think we're basically talking about different aspects of the same phenomenon.
Is there any, another outside question, is there any way that the United States can assume a more balanced approach to Israel and Palestine?
Well, yeah, I was in Europe right in the middle of the Jenin business, and it's just astonishing. I mean, you know, it's as if you're looking at two different conflicts. I mean, and I think that's really across the board in terms of it's not a simply a left-right split. I mean, I think it's a very deep and abiding difference. And you know, I guess the most I could say there is that if you actually got a settlement that was you know, that was again brokered by the United States, like Camp David, that the Europeans would, you know, eventually grudgingly go along with it, but they're certainly not going to get there, I think on their own. But that's a that's a whole other can of worms that
come back again.
Yeah, right.
John?
Yeah.
Short question.
Returning to the main theme of your remarks. Excuse me. Returning to the main theme of your remarks, I was struck by your concluding point, comparing theory and practice, and concluding with the quote, with the slogan from the American Dollar Bill, which seems to appeal to a higher order, which is where you started with respect to European thinking at this point in time. And I'm wondering, is there something to be said that what we're wrestling with and what your analysis is pointing toward is something that's still unresolved and still unfolding about how the democratic community, a term that we've used, how it deals with its interactions amongst itself? That was never really defined. We came to a democratic world comprising a certain number of nations, especially the Atlantic community, but it was never defined how that community should deal with the issues that are important to it in an interchangeable sense.
Question, John?
And so the question is, do you think we're facing Are we facing the unfolding of how a democratic community should function?
Well, we did have an answer, which was the one referred to by Professor Claude, which is that we dealt with it in terms of sovereign nation states interacting on a, you know, contractual basis through conventional international law. But I think that, you know, one of the questions that's out there is that, you know, in a way there's a democratic deficit at an international level because you have all these other components of global governance, you know, all these partial institutions mostly dealing with the economy, but some dealing with, you know, different aspects of environment, politics, and so forth. But you do not have the ultimate source of legitimacy on at an international level, which is a legislature, you know, which can express institutionally the will of a broader international community above the level of the nation state. And I suspect that there are probably a lot of Europeans that think that all of these different institutions that are slowly being put in place is, you know, working towards, you know, this kind of goal, just as in the European Union, there's been the steady, you know, giving up of sovereignty in favor of the creation of a European, you know, level of democracy. Now, Europeans, I mean, I think this is crazy. They will never get there. I don't think that there is any form of global democracy in that sense that is practical, and all the practical ones are not going to be democratic, and I think it's a conundrum that will never be solved. They may be able to solve it at a European level, although, you know, if you look at the criticisms of the democratic deficit in the European Union, I mean, they are perfectly reasonable, you know, criticisms that the decisions that are made in Brussels, you know, are put through this sausage machine, you know, or this Rube Goldberg contraption of such an unbelievable, you know, degree of complexity that what comes out, you know, is just very hard to square with the popular will, or, you know, and citizens' connections with those decisions, you know, is extremely attenuated. And so, yes, I think the, you know, I mean, you know, a typical criticism, American criticism of the criminal court is that courts like that make sense when they are enforcing a clear body of law, you know, put forward by a legislature in a system of checks and balances in which there are some checks on the power of, you know, of the court, and that exists in the American constitutional system. Logically, that could exist at an international level if you had the equivalent of democratic accountability, you know, through a world parliament or something, but that's not going to exist, and so then you have to take, you know, this very partial, unchecked institution just by itself, and I think it does point to the fact that there is a democratic deficit at the global level. And it's not just that nobody's been smart enough to figure out how to solve it. I just think it's an unsolvable problem. So therefore, this is going to continue to be a, you know, an issue.
We've reached our normal adjournment time. There are questions that we haven't even read, such as how could we get out of Germany and Japan in 5 to 10 years? But you say we're caught in Iraq for several generations. I don't know if you want to very briefly touch that, or whether you leave that for a few minutes later. There will be an opportunity for some of you who have questions to meet with our speaker. We hope all of you will add your voice to the voice that I've tried to express over the years, that having heard him once, we'd like to hear him a number of times, and we have, now that he's not an administrator, they tried to make him an administrator, he's now only dean of faculty, which was a compromise at SAIS, but maybe he has a lot more time to come to places like this, so we look forward to your return.
Thank you. Oh, thank you.